Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point. In the news this week, widespread furor and dismay over President Trump's alleged vulgar slur about Haiti and African countries. Retiring Florida Congresswoman Ileana Ros-Lehtinen said she's appalled.
It really takes your breath away. It's just incomprehensible that these words came out of the mouth of the President of the United States of America.
On Tuesday, Senator Dianne Feinstein, the top Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, released the transcript of an August meeting on the unverified dossier documenting connections between the Trump campaign and Russia.
I think people are entitled to know what was said, and the lawyers also wanted it released. I see no problem with releasing it.
And deadly mudslides devastate California. Mark O'Farrell captured this cell phone video of a river of mud rushing down his street in Montecito.
Turn around! The flash flood's right there! The flash flood's right there! Get out of here! Go! Oh my God, Mom!
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable, with Margaret Brennan, McKay Coppins, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What do you say to the foul language coming out of the Oval Office? Are you buying the president's denial it was used? What does this do, if anything, to the reputation of the United States? Joining us now from Washington is Margaret Brennan, White House correspondent and senior foreign affairs correspondent for CBS News. Margaret, great to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
Also from Washington, McKay Coppins, staff writer for The Atlantic, joins us. McKay, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Ray, Margaret, and McKay.
So, Margaret, quiet morning at the White House. Anything going on there?
Is it ever a quiet morning? No. Look, the Trump White House took its time overnight, not denying those comments directly yesterday. And today, the president did finally take to Twitter to generally deny that any comments were made as quoted, but has said that they were salty remarks. That's all that he's owning at this point. But what we know is that this has caused a political backlash in Washington. It's also caused a diplomatic incident in Haiti, with the top U.S. diplomat there getting summoned in to try to explain exactly what the president was trying to say, and to do so to the president of Haiti, who is demanding an explanation. The State Department is preparing for this to happen in perhaps other countries in Africa as well. And this morning you have now, you know, for those who are questioning whether the president said these reported remarks, you now have Senator Dick Durbin, who was in the Oval Office on Thursday, talking through this immigration reform package on the record, saying, yes, the president repeatedly used that word to refer to people from Haiti and Africa. He says, to his credit, that his Republican colleague, Lindsey Graham, who was also in the Oval Office, stood up and said, excuse me, Mr. President, and interrupted him and tried to correct him on using that kind of language. So now you have at least two senators being on the record in association with these remarks, in contrast to what the president is saying, which is a total denial.
Here's Trump's tweet, quote, "Never said anything derogatory about Haitians other than Haiti is obviously a very poor and troubled country. Never said take them out. Made up by Dems. I have a wonderful relationship with Haitians. Probably should record future meetings. Unfortunately, no trust." Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin, as Margaret mentioned, was in the Oval Office yesterday during the immigration meeting where President Trump allegedly used vulgar language, and confirmed this morning the president did make those remarks.
You've seen the comments in the press. I have not read one of them that's inaccurate. To no surprise, the president started tweeting this morning denying that he used those words. It is not true. He said these hate-filled things, and he said them repeatedly.
The story broke last night, and right away the backlash started to gather in the broadcast media and on social media. CNN's Don Lemon didn't pull any punches when he opened his show last night, sharply criticizing President Trump for the comments.
The president of the United States is racist. A lot of us already knew that. Today, President Trump, talking with lawmakers in the Oval Office about immigrants from Haiti, from El Salvador, and Africa, said, and I quote, "Why are we having all these people from countries come here?"
Jack Beatty, what did you make of it?
Well, you know, last week the focus was on Mr. Trump's mental competence and emotional stability. And there's a lot there. There's a lot to make one worry about that. There's a Wall Street Journal transcript of an interview with him today that reads like something from David Mamet via Ulysses thrown in with some New York saltiness. It's an incoherent jumble. But the problem all along and concurrently really is a moral one. The president is a man of you know, deeply flawed moral character. I mean, there's just no question about it. He lies. The Washington Post now has documented 2,000 falsehoods, false statements since inauguration. And he is a bigot. And that violates sort of basic notions of contemporary moral probity. And this what's wrong with the president isn't some pathology. Maybe there is something there, but what seems flagrantly wrong is his character, his continual and habitual violation of norms about presidents and about just decent human beings that Americans have had to accept from him, his affronts to the best in our tradition.
I will let others comment on the comments and typify them, but what struck me was its ahistoricism. I would only remind people whose ancestors came here from other places in the world that, let's say, 110 years ago, Ireland, Lithuania, Poland, Sicily, Calabria, the Tsarist Empire, the Ottoman Empire, were not among the garden spots of the world. And it's why people wanted to get out of them and come where? To the United States of America. If we're talking about Norway, one of the countries with the highest per capita GDP in the world, and one of the measured highest rates of happiness, I'm not sure that a lot of Norwegians want to come to the United States right now. McKay Coppins, when we look at the sum total of what the president's been saying in recent weeks, turning back temporary protected status for Salvadorans, earlier for Haitians and Nicaraguans, disparaging the lottery system that brings people here from a mix of countries in the world, the literal favoring of people from places like Norway. Is there now an opening to conclude that he wants to bend the demographic curve, that he wants to revoke the demography that has us heading for, in 2044, minority-majority America?
Well, it certainly can be argued that's at least part of his agenda here. And stepping away from the president, many of his most vocal and high-profile defenders have explicitly said this, or at least they've made the case in reverse, that the Democrats just want to bring these people into the country and give them legal status and voting rights because it'll help the Democratic Party. It creates more Democratic voters. So it's clear that at least many of Trump's defenders, supporters, surrogates think about immigration in these terms. They think about them in partisan political terms and in demographic terms. It's hard to be, you know, the individual comments I think are shocking to a lot of people, and they should be. But it's also true that this is in keeping with who Donald Trump has been from the beginning. This is a man who kicked off his campaign in the summer of 2015 by promising to build a wall to keep out Mexican rapists and murderers, saying that when countries send people here, they're not sending their best. This has been not only a consistent message throughout his campaign, throughout his political life, it has been arguably the founding cause of it, the core issue driving all of it. And so this is of a piece of a broader agenda that I think he's been telling us about from the very beginning.
I want to hear from a lot of you this hour. We'll start in Providence, Rhode Island. Sarah's calling. Sarah, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead, Sarah.
I'm curious about the focus on the language that he used rather than the sentiment, which your panel has been talking about. Why has there been less focus on the sentiment rather than the vulgar language?
Well, Sarah, don't you think it's unusual enough to hear that a president has said this in a meeting with elected officials, that at least at the beginning, the language is going to get a lot of attention? We should talk about the embedded sentiment. Absolutely. But isn't that language also going to raise some eyebrows?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's the meaning behind the language that has the most impact and on individuals and the groups of individuals and the perception of America across the globe.
Let me quickly turn to Margaret Brennan before we go to the break. What quickly has the White House said, either in defense or explanation?
Well, as I said, they didn't deny this last night, none of the people who speak for the president, at least. What they did try to do is to give some quote-unquote context around it, which is that there was the statement issued in the name of Ross Shaw, one of the press secretaries here at the White House, who was saying that, you know, the president has been fighting for the for Americans, and he wants people who can contribute to U.S. society. That's a nod to what the president has said should be new standards for immigration that favors those, what he called merit-based individuals, people who are highly skilled or highly educated over those who are highly in need. It's something that he has said should be used to rewrite immigration law. And that would exclude some of those who've been given temporary protected status, like El Salvadorians and Haitians. And
we're talking about the week's top stories. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? And what can a tuna cannery in the middle of the Pacific tell us about taxes? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator, a new podcast from Planet Money, where in every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Get it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're talking about the week in the news. You can join the conversation. How's the DACA debate affecting your life? Are you fearful for friends, for neighbors, for yourself? Conservative commentator Ann Coulter spoke with Fox Business host Lou Dobbs after President Trump's Tuesday meeting with congressional leaders on DACA. She called it the lowest day of his presidency and said he has to remain tough on immigration.
His only hope is to be pedal to the metal, fulfill his promises, build the wall, end chain migration, and deport these dreamers who are the worst of the illegals.
My guests this hour, Margaret Brennan of CBS, McKay Coppins of The Atlantic, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Margaret, is there any daylight on DACA? And especially now that we're getting close to the 19th and the deadline for funding the operations of the federal government.
Well, look, this is something that earlier in this week the president had sort of offered up to Democrats saying, look, I'll give you DACA. Look, I will reverse my decision to end the program that shields, you know, roughly 700,000 people from deportation if you work with me on these other things. But now in the wake of these comments, he has lent a level of toxicity to this issue. He needed bipartisan support on anything, to get done, whether it was DACA or keeping the government funded or any of the other things he's going to be trying to do. And he has made things more difficult for himself by making it harder and harder and harder for Democrats to reach across the aisle in the wake of these comments about Haitians and Africans and some of the others, including El Salvadorians. So the president has made things more difficult for himself. This could have a political cost here, yes. Remember, it's the 19th that we are expecting, just next Friday, the government to run out of funding, a potential government shutdown. So he needs to be able to work with people right now. So it's interesting to see how on Capitol Hill some Republicans might, after strongly embracing the president in these past few weeks, question whether they need to distance themselves from him in the wake of these comments, or whether this is just another one of the news cycles that we've gotten used to where this blows over tomorrow. It is just the incoming of news in this administration has made all of us, I think, question what actually holds a political cost and what will get lost in the next 24-hour cycle. But the reason that we're talking about the language, the reason that we're talking about these groups of people is because this level of specificity, who gets protected status, who gets counted within the visa lottery system, et cetera, actually does need to be nailed down. And so the details are always where immigration reform gets caught up and hasn't been possible for Presidents Bush or Obama. On the issue of DACA, which is people already here, already contributing, already working, and with work permits, the president has said he wants to usher that in, that new protection. Now, it's not clear he's going to get the transaction he wanted, so it's not clear if he's actually going to follow through on that.
Natick, Massachusetts is next. Sam, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thank you for taking my call. As always, we should all support NPR for centering on things that concerns every human being on earth. Ray, here is the problem. It is extremely very nice and informative that we elected Mr. Trump to scratch off the surface of what has been going on in job places, in academia, everywhere you go. By the way, I graduated from BU, you know, I graduated from Northeastern BU, and et cetera, and with, you know, two master's degree and doctor of medicine and bachelor's degree, of course. But I've been called nigga many times. They have even typed it in the system. So this is it's a shame and a charade that we are even talking about this.
Sam, from your accent, sounds like you're a West African. Where are you from?
Nigeria.
Okay, well, the president mentioned supposedly the week before last, I think it was, that once Nigerians see the United States, they won't want to go back to their huts. It sounds like you don't want to go back to your hut. You're living there in Natick. But Nigerians are also the best, not among the best, not one of the best educated immigrants in the United States are Nigerians. And you mentioned you're an MD and you have two master's degrees. So I guess you fit that bill.
How many questions? Okay, here is my question to you. Given that statistics, how many Nigerians who are here who have this level of education are in management position in all their job places? How many?
Well, that I don't know. It sounds like you're saying it's not enough.
No, zero. None. Tell me one. Give one example. None. They have to answer yes, sir, to someone who have obviously, you know, should be their coffee boy.
That's a different issue, but Sam, I'm glad you called. Sam calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Columbia, South Carolina is next. Rich, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Hi, Rich.
I'd like to chime in on two things. First, I can't agree with Jack Beatty more strongly. I'm a very conservative Republican, and for me to say that says something. I completely agree with the lack of moral foundation in Trump compromises everything he's trying to do. It's just embarrassing. On the DACA issue, I actually am a project manager for a construction company, and I can tell you our immigration system is broken. For Ann Coulter to say that the DACA people are the worst is ridiculous. I interact with those kind of folks on a regular basis, and they are exemplary as a general rule. We have got to acknowledge the reality that we do have a moral responsibility to kids who were brought here, And to just say build a wall is absolutely a cop-out. We have got to change it from fundamentally from guest worker visas or whatever the options may be. Things have got to change. And I'm going to tell you, there's a lot of conservative Republicans who think the same way.
Well, one of them is David Perdue of Georgia, United States Senator, who attended President Trump's bipartisan meeting on DACA Tuesday and urged the president to streamline immigration reform and agreed with his colleague, Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin, on what could be done.
Limiting this to the legal immigration side and combining the balance between various solutions on DACA, Dreamers, if that gets in the conversation, as well as border security and chain migration. I think therein lies the balance of a good deal that can be done. And I agree with Dick. I don't think it's going to take long to get it done if we just locked ourselves in a room and made it happen.
McKay Coppins, you heard our caller's frustration from South Carolina about the president undermining himself. You've been watching this. Is there any truth to that?
There, of course it's true. I mean, you talk to members of Capitol Hill on both parties, members of Congress, their aides. And they'll tell you that one of the most frustrating things about this issue in particular is that there is actually a deal within reach. Just yesterday we saw it reported that the bipartisan group of six senators had reached a deal in principle on immigration that would cover DACA, border security, some of these immigration issues. They took it to the White House, and this is what happened. The president derailed the whole thing with these completely toxic, poisonous comments that caused a major national firestorm, rightfully so. And now this is where we're at on this issue. You talk to Democrats in particular. When I talk to Democrats on Capitol Hill, they'll say part of the problem with the White House is that you can unlike past presidents, unlike past White Houses of both parties, you can't count on them to be negotiating in good faith. You can get in a room with the president, his senior advisors, think that you're all on the same page generally. And then, an hour later or a day later, the president is in a different mood or he talks to someone else or he sees something on cable news and he starts firing off tweets that undermine the state of the negotiations. And then you have to start all over again. And I think that this gets at the fundamental problem with this administration, which is not just ideological or partisan or political, it's also just competence. This White House has not shown an ability to build compromise, build consensus for all of Trump's reputation as a deal maker. They have not figured out how to make deals on issues where there is a deal to be made, like this one.
Dina is calling us from Lisbon, New York. Dina, welcome.
Yes. Hi, Ray. My question is, I don't know if anyone on your panel can help me understand this any better. I believe that Mr. Trump has staffing in Mar-a-Lago in his golf resort in Florida that are there on special seasonal visas from other countries. So I'm really confused as to why he wants to crack down on immigration, but yet it seems as though he depends on some immigrants to staff Mar-a-Lago in Florida.
Jack Beatty, there's a kind of, I don't know, what's the word, brazenness about asserting, as Dina mentions, the crackdown on who gets in, and yet every news cycle since every renewal cycle since he's become a candidate, Trump's properties have petitioned for more special visas for seasonal workers.
Yes, and it was reported on CNN last night that Haitian workers are it's a leading group at Mar-a-Lago. So I think Dina is right about that. Rich was raising the issue of sort of Republican reaction to Trump, and 64% of Republicans, according to the latest Quinnipiac poll, want the Dreamers to stay and to apply for citizenship. So it's overwhelming on the Republican side wanting this, and yet the president, who professes his desire to see it done, also seems to be at the mercy of his advisor, Stephen Miller, the scourge of Hispanics at Santa Monica High School, who seems to distill the poison of sort of 19th century know-nothingism, you know, the view of immigrants as somehow poisoning the national well. And this view of somehow being poisoned and undermined and dirt, you know, psychologists see this as one of the elements in sort of deep conservatism, a fear of infection and of those who will infect us. And Mr. Trump brings that out and plays to it. And last night, the White House put out a statement saying, pretty much, this will appeal to his base, or words to that effect, which, of course, is an insult to the base, but there's also something to it, isn't there? That there's a grain of American anxiety that responds to these cues about infection and about people from of color and about the national demography being thrown off its white supremacist axis.
Kyle writes on Twitter, "I'm tired of our State Department having to do damage control for our president that doesn't think before he speaks, instead of doing their job, which is state building and diplomacy." Gopal writes on Twitter, "Norway has something good going. Their schools are tops in the world, healthcare for everyone, the government runs great. Why would they want to come here?" Boston, Massachusetts is next. Anne, you're on the line.
Hi, Ray. Thank you for taking my call. I had a career change, and I am now from the business world, and I am now teaching English as a second language to adult students here in Alston. And before I got into that, I never knew about immigration in the sense of what they have to go through or these temporary programs. It was all new to me. But what I have, so I've learned a little bit about them and DACA, but what I've seen is I've seen my adult students, some of them who are coming from these horrible countries with violence and no opportunity and things, but they're coming here with third grade educations, maybe a fifth grade education. They come through my classroom, and I teach an intermediate and advanced. I see them growing as humans, as individuals, as people, and contributing. And when DACA came through, a few of our students, or several of our students, were able to get something so they could come out of the shadows. I know the third woman who had the third grade education, she started a business. The guy with the fifth grade education, business. The temporary folks, one of my best students from Haiti, hardworking guy. These are people you want to keep. They have shown. They want to be here. They're contributing. They're working for an adult student to come twice a week to a class to try to learn the language and to better themselves. And several have moved on to get a high school diploma. These are the kind of people that we're not hearing about, and most people don't because they're not exposed to it. But to try to take away DACA, to put these people either back in the shadows, it's just, last night I apologized to my class because there's a student from El Salvador, and I don't know if he's on the temporary. We don't ask those questions, but I just told them, you know, how sorry I am for what's going on, and I apologized for he's not my president, but I apologized for the president of our country and told them I'm really sorry because these are people that are doing good things that are contributing to our country, and they deserve, you know, we need some common sense. You know, if temporary is not 15 years, if people have been living here building their lives, let's give them, and paying taxes, let's give them a path to citizenship. Let's give them an opportunity to contribute like our grandparents and great-grandparents did.
Let me turn at this point, Anne, to Margaret Brennan, because I'm wondering about the politics of this. We heard Jack citing a poll. We heard our conservative Republican caller from South Carolina saying, look, just get it done already. Don't concentrate on kicking them out. We heard Anne talking about the people working hard to become Americans. Yet we have this state that we're in right now. The politics on this don't seem to favor the president numerically.
You're right. I mean, on the DACA issue, which you can separate out from some of the more complicated things that the president was talking about when he made these derogatory comments, he was talking about visa lottery and some of the bigger issues. On DACA, which should be the easier here in that you have both sides saying they want to get it done, again, these latest comments make it more difficult for Democrats to choose to reach across the aisle and work with this president. You had Dick Durbin, a Democrat, doing just that in the Oval Office when these comments were made. And so that is why it is self-defeating in many ways for all of this to be coming out. Look, you know, for anyone who just recently watched that Vietnam documentary on PBS and heard some of those recordings of Nixon and LBJ from the Oval Office, President Trump's not the first guy to swear and use this kind of language in the Oval to refer to other people. But the reason that this is becoming a political issue is because, A, it directly affects the mechanics of the laws that are trying to be written here, and B, because these kind of things come up again and again and again with the president. Racially tinged, innuendo, things like that, that once again start to break apart the Republican Party. It is the politics of division. And for the president, particularly in the past week and a half, he had in many ways started to turn the page on that, embracing many of the Republican establishment figures that he had promised to sort of overthrow.
That's Margaret Brennan from CBS News. We're taking a look at the week's news. It's On Point.
Up first, it may be just the podcast you didn't know you were looking for. It's the Morning News Podcast from NPR. You can put it on during breakfast or while you're commuting, and you'll be caught up for the day in just about 10 minutes. That's it. Find Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. In other news this week, the Me Too movement was front and center at the Golden Globes Sunday night. Here's Nicole Kidman, receiving Best Actress in a miniseries for Big Little Lies, in which she played a survivor of domestic abuse.
This character that I played represents something that is the center of our conversation right now, abuse. I do believe and I hope we can elicit change through the stories we tell and the way we tell them.
Monday, a federal judge dismissed charges against Cliven Bundy, the Nevada rancher involved in an armed standoff over land grazing fees in 2014.
One thing for sure, I'm going to go back and ranch. I'm going to produce you people some more food, and I'm going to fight for your freedom and liberty to come out onto your land and enjoy your land.
And the Alabama Crimson Tide won its fifth national title in 9 seasons by defeating Georgia 26-23 in overtime in Monday night's college football playoff national championship. Here's ESPN's Chris Fowler with the call.
Fires to the end zone. Touchdown! Alabama wins!
You can join the conversation. Don't call about the Crimson Tide. Have talks between North Korea and South Korea eased your fears of war? What's your top story this week? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. My guests this hour, Margaret Brennan of CBS, McKay Coppins of The Atlantic, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. One blast from the near past showing that a presidential pardon can revive and re-energize a career is Joe Arpaio, former sheriff of Maricopa County, Arizona, now running for the U.S. Senate. He revived debates surrounding President Obama's birth certificate this week by calling the document a forgery. Here he is on CNN's Cuomo Primetime Wednesday.
You believe that President Obama's birth certificate is a phony?
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. We have the evidence. I'm not going to go into all the details.
You know, even Donald Trump now says that he believes that the president was born in this country, right?
He never said about a fake birth certificate. That's the only thing I was trying to prove.
McKay Coppins, as the Republicans prepare the midterm campaigns, is Joe Arpaio their friend?
Well, it depends on which Republicans you ask. I actually talked to Joe Arpaio this week and you know, pressed him on some of these issues. The thing about Arpaio is that he's been a kind of national lightning rod for years now, right? He was spent more than two decades as sheriff of Maricopa County in Arizona, and in 2010 really became a national figure for being one of the most outspoken champions of Arizona's pretty harsh and draconian immigration crackdown. What he told me, which was interesting, is that he actually sees the Republican Party as having moved sharply in his direction in recent years, right? I mean, look, this is a guy who for a long time was kind of treated as a fringe sideshow character. But now he sees a Republican Party that nominated, Donald Trump, birther in chief, to be their candidate, their nominee in 2016, who went on to be president. Arpaio actually had a speaking slot at the Republican National Convention in 2016. So he thinks that this is his moment. This is the political climate is conducive to a kind of nativist candidate like him. For the institutional Republican Party in Washington, D.C., you talk to people there and they are dreading more figures like Joe Arpaio getting into the Republican primaries this year because they're terrified of more repeats of the Alabama special election where a more fringe candidate ends up winning the Republican primary and then coughs up seats that they should otherwise win. That Arizona Senate race They have a tough Democrat to beat in Kristen Sinema, and they need a real candidate who they feel like can resonate with a majority of Arizonans, and that it's not at all clear that would be Joe Arpaio.
Well, if Joe Arpaio is Exhibit A for one side of the argument, Margaret Brennan, lo, how the mighty have fallen. Steve Bannon is not only out of the White House; he's out at Breitbart. Now he's facing questioning from the Russia investigation and from congressional committees. What's up with a man who might have been called at one time one of the central architects of Trumpism?
Indeed. Well, Steve Bannon, through some of the people around him, has communicated to the press that he intends to try to remain a political figure here. He may not be involved with Breitbart anymore. They made a business decision at that publication that it wouldn't work anymore for him to be running that organization. But he expects to still be involved politically and push some of these candidates who represent whatever may exist of a wing of the Republican Party associated with Trumpism. But as for what many thought Bannon represented in this White House, I think the fact that this issue has come up once again, these allegations of racially tinged or issues, they're no longer just associated with Bannonism. They are associated strongly with the president at this point. And I think that some of that will continue to be if the president speaks this way in private. But as for that nationalist populist movement, we'll see who ends up at the forefront of it. It appears that it remains the president of the United States at this point. It's just whether or not the rest of the Republican Party is going to continue to support it. Because right now, while you're seeing condemnation of the president's remarks, you aren't seeing the Republicans in Congress really challenge the president in any way that would cause him a political loss, other than not getting a few bills through. Anyone who's talking about the things that were alleged in Michael Wolff's book, relying heavily on Steve Bannon's comments, questioning the president's mental stability, and claiming that people in the cabinet and others had been talking about trying to get the president out of power due to their concerns, we just aren't seeing that kind of momentum on Capitol Hill. So it's interesting to see where Steve Bannon ends up. But right now, it appears Trumpism is still alive in the White House and those things that were very much associated with his legacy here.
Essex Junction, Vermont is our next stop. Bill, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Ray. I'm going to be all over the charts for a second, but first off, the concern of immigrants coming to the country is, I think a lot of them are coming and filling jobs that nobody wants to do, and, the drug crisis, the opioids, we know where heroin comes from, and now kids are eating freaking bad, or the laundry detergent. I mean, these are our kids, and if people are coming from other countries and they're willing to work and these guys aren't, what's the scoop, you know? And but with Steve Bannon, who flip-flops, and Joe Ipano or whatever his name is, or just people who are just totally racist, and I don't understand how our government can deal with this stuff.
That's Bill from Essex Junction, Vermont. Thanks for your call. We'll go next to Atlanta, Georgia. Joe is on the line. Joe, welcome to On Point. Hey, Joe.
Comment is about papaya. Mm-hmm. I mean, Republicans should learn a lesson from what happened in Alabama. I mean, Joe should not be in that because he has violated our law. Now, if we elect him as a senator, the senators are responsible for the laws of the land. He himself has violated the law, and then here he is coming to be in the Senate for him to help us to go into law. I don't think the Republicans should allow him to do that because it's not giving a good example. I think that Alabama should they should learn from it and then think about it. That the senators are for the country, not for individual rights.
Well, Joe Arpaio has a rough road forward because he first has to win the Republican nomination and then go against a Democratic candidate in a state that that may be ripe for a Democratic pickup. I don't know. It's been purplish or flirting with purple-tood, but still a pretty red state. Joe calling us from Atlanta, Georgia. Let's look at the international scene for a bit. Representatives from North Korea and South Korea met Tuesday for the first high-level talk in 2 years between the two countries. North Korea agreed to send a delegation to the Winter Olympics next month in Pyeongchang, South Korea. The two sides announced a future military talk, the reinstatement of a hotline, and other dialogue to ease tensions between the countries. Here's North Korea's chief negotiator, Ri Sun-gwan.
It wouldn't be an overstatement to say the inter-Korean relationship is more frozen than the natural climate. But despite the cold weather, the people's desire for the improvement of inter-Korean relationship remains unfrozen.
Jack Beatty, the president, has been talking about the Koreas as well.
He has, and the president, President Moon of Korea, shrewdly gives President Trump credit for the warming or the slight thawing in inter-Korean relations, and that's that's the way to get to Mr. Trump's heart by flattering him. But you know, while this is going on, this, you know, move toward the North Koreans going to participate in the Olympic Games. We read in the Financial Times a big takeout on the perils of preemptive war. That is still in the air, and there's talk, I guess, in the White House or security circles about giving Kim a quote a kick in the shin. Or a bloody nose. And some of the things they're talking about, well, why don't we destroy one of Kim's homes? Or go after one of the naval facilities? Or, in other words, something that isn't going to provoke him to... Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, something that isn't going to provoke him to retaliate at what level of ferocity we don't know. This is very disturbing. And the piece goes on to say, what kind of CIA director could go to the president and say, you know, we think you can do this without having some catastrophic reaction. Kim will accept the bloody nose. No kind of CIA director, except who's in the wings to be the CIA director. According to what one reads, Senator Cotton of Arkansas, who never met a war he didn't like. This is a scary moment.
Margaret Brennan, is there serious talk about the United States getting militarily involved in the Korea Peninsula, more than just having troops stationed there to watch the DMZ?
These comments that were recently reported in terms of military options are not new. They may be new to the public, but they've been talked about for more than a year now of the Trump administration. It's what the Pentagon does. They come up with all these different scenarios. What you are hearing increasingly, and I thought it was remarkable, actually, that the president very strongly continued to emphasize his support for diplomacy, diplomacy first, and not just diplomacy in terms of sanctions and pressure, but diplomacy in terms of actually talking. He had a different tone this week. It wasn't a different policy. It was a different tone to say he was really heartened. He said he saw good things coming from these historic talks between North and South Korea. Yes, it was on a very narrow issue, the Olympics, but the fact that anyone was sitting down and talking with North Korea is new and it is progress. And it may be, diplomats are quite hopeful, the kind of opening, the kind of signal that there is something more to engage on. Because remember, the U.S., you could say, gave a little here. They did give a gesture. They offered to delay some of the U.S. military exercises that typically happen in order to deconflict them, so to speak, with the Olympics. That's a give. That was a signal. That was a gesture by the United States. So if anything, I'd say right now, diplomacy is the foot forward. Whether it ever goes anywhere and the military option has to be the one used is a different matter.
Well, we have a caller from Dayton, Ohio, Carl, who says we have a moral obligation to go to war with North Korea. Take that country's regime out. They're just like the Nazis in World War II. The Kim family has killed so many people. Jack, this would speak to your idea that war is now thinkable in a way that maybe it wasn't before.
Well, I mean, on the other side, they're closer than ever before to having a full-fledged nuclear capability, capable even of reaching the east coast of the United States. So that alone would bring the talk of war closer. But preventive war, Bismarck, I think, really put it well when he said, preventive war is like a man killing himself, committing suicide from fear of death. It doesn't work. It's immoral because, of course, you're saying we're going to destroy you because you might hit us. That's pretty much what we were doing in Iraq, and that look at the disaster that led to. And to keep talking about this, as experts say, it creates the sense of a crisis. It creates the sense of a miscalculation. Yes, we should all welcome what's going on now. But, in a week from now, will the president be back? Button is bigger than your button. In the Wall Street Journal interview I alluded to, he says, Kim and I have a good relationship. What is he talking about?
Neil writes, the mudslides and floods in California are staggering. In any other presidency, this would be the main focus. Martin writes, where's the leadership in Congress? Ryan's and McConnell's silence is deafening. And another listener writes, look at Trump's history, not just in the past 2 to 3 years. When it comes to race, this is nothing new. Tom writes, we have a clear choice. We either become used to each new shocking low or we decide to utterly reject it. Each week is like an alarm clock going off. More wake up each week, but far too many just decide to hit the snooze button and let it become normal. Margaret Brennan, White House correspondent and senior foreign affairs correspondent for CBS News, thanks for being with us today.
Great to be with you.
McKay Coppins, staff writer for The Atlantic. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
And as always, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you very much.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio or follow me at Ray Suarez News. Coming up Monday, 9 million children and families could lose their health care coverage if CHIP funding expires. We'll go to the health care front lines. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.